We're in the process of preparing that letter. The complexity of Governor or Senator Grassley's request is that he's asked for a legal opinion, which we're in the process of preparing. But honestly, Senator Grassley, since he's and all of the colleagues who signed that letter, they know the situation with our budget. They know that the operating budget of USDA, when the sequester goes into effect 11/59 tonight, is less than it was in 2009. Less than it was in 2009. And so we've obviously had, over the course of the last several years, with increased expenses, we've obviously had to be very efficient, or more efficient than we were. So what did we do? Well, the first thing is we put together over 1,000 USDA employees from all mission areas, and we said, what can we do better? What can we do less of? What can we do more of that would make us more efficient? And they came back with a blueprint, 340 recommendations, some of which were things we were already doing, so we wanted to continue to do them, about 240 new recommendations. So we began the process of instituting those new recommendations. What did they involve? Well, first of all, they involved taking a look at offices and labs that we no longer needed to remain open, that we no longer could afford to keep open. So we announced last year roughly 250 labs and offices and locations that we would no longer be able to afford. We've started a process of early retirements and early separation programs, which has resulted over a period of time of our workforce being reduced by roughly 6,800 workers, which represents about 8% of our full-time workforce. We began the process of strategically sourcing, which is that departments would, instead of buying stuff on their own, they would come together and collaborate and offer a single contract for certain activities, certain supplies, clothing, things of that nature. We save money doing that. We looked at the remaining space that we had after we closed offices and said, are there any ways, particularly in the D.C. area, we could consolidate space and maybe use more of our buildings more efficiently? So we reduced the rent that we were paying for a number of places. We looked at our technology expenditures and realized that people were buying stuff without knowing what other departments and agencies were doing, and that we needed to come together collectively and work strategically. All of that was done, and the sum total of savings was a conservative number, $700 million. Probably it's more likely closer to $1 billion because of the personnel reductions. So, and we cut travel, we cut supplies, we cut conferences, and we did this before anybody asked us to do it, or anybody told us to do it, or anybody suggested we should do it. Honestly, instead of writing letters, it would be helpful if Congress would write a bill and get it passed. It's in their hands to solve this. We have to implement the process they created, they passed, they approved. And we're going to implement it, and we're going to try to do it based on the principles I just articulated. We're going to try to do it as equitably to producers and the folks we serve as possible. I mean, when you've got a situation where you've made some payments in a program and others have yet to receive their payment, does the sequester amount apply only to those monies that have yet to go out, or does it apply to those monies that have gone out and you need to recoup, or are there other ways in which you can make sure that people are treated equitably? We've spent an enormous amount of time on this to try to plan for it, in addition to planning for shutdown, in addition not to having a budget, in addition to not having a farm bill. So with due respect to Senator Grassley, who I have a lot of respect for, we will answer his letter, and we'll do it fully and completely. And I can assure him and his colleagues that we are doing what we can. Number one. Number two, it's not as if in the inspection area in particular we can take money from some other mission area and shift it over to food safety so we don't have to do what we have to do. We can't do that. We cannot do that. It's not as if within the food safety budget we have flexibility. Here's why. 87%, roughly 87% of that budget is people who are inspectors and the money that supports the people who are inspectors. 5% of that budget is operating expense, and the balance is for people who work doing the testing and the analysis and the backroom stuff. The law basically limits the amount of furloughs we can give to any one individual to 22 days. So you could furlough everybody else other than inspectors for 22 days, and you would still have to furlough inspectors. And by furloughing those other people, the inspectors wouldn't be able to fully do their job because they depend in part on what those other folks are doing. Secondly, a furlough and the length of the furlough depends on the depth of the cut and how much time you have to implement the cut. So if the cut is hypothetically 6% and you have the full year to do it, that's one thing. But when you only have a half a year, it's 12% of the remaining money that you have in order to get to the 6% annually. You also have to factor into the equation the notice that you've got to give under the bargaining agreements. And in the inspector's agreement, there is an oral conference requirement in addition to a notice requirement. So what that does is it condenses the amount of time in which we have to affect the savings to meet the goal established by Congress, which Congress could prevent by passing a budget and doing their job.
Yeah? Mr. Secretary, in your remarks, you said the drought of 2012 was a wake-up call. You called for more spending for researching the climate change.
Not more spending. Not necessarily more spending.
Redirecting.
Right.
Could you go into more detail on what you're looking for
next? Well, basically, we want to equip producers with information, as good information as we can possibly get, on how they might go about mitigating or adapting to a changing climate. I was visiting with some folks yesterday who talked about areas of the country where wheat was being produced years ago, where it's not being produced today because the weather just doesn't fit wheat production. It's now transitioned to corn and soybean production. So we have to be aware of the telltale signs of that happening. We have to be aware of what strategies could be utilized. We have to be aware of what seed technologies could be developed that would enable producers to produce more with less, whether it's less water, less sunlight, less fertilizer, less chemicals, whatever it is. That involves research, and it involves research that recognizes that every part of the country is different. It's not as if we could set up one research project and do agriculture. It's really you have to establish sort of a regional presence so there's an understanding of what that region produces and what the impacts and effects of climate change will be. The coast areas are different than the middle of the country. The south is different than the northwest. So it is about that, and it's about raising the awareness of what techniques currently exist. And part of that is the multi-cropping discussion, the cover crop discussion, which we are also engaged in sort of simultaneously with this climate change effort, and recognizing that there are barriers. There's potentially a lack of market opportunity, which makes it less likely that a producer would do this because they can't cash flow it. And there may be producers that could cash flow it and or aren't worried about the cash flow implications of it but don't understand the conservation benefits that can accrue. So it's a massive effort to recognize that these intense weather patterns are not just an isolated incident. They are what we are likely to see, a continuing pattern of more intensity. The fact that we're dealing with pine bark beetle and other critters in the West and the impact that they're having on the forest isn't just coincidental. That's a function of a changing climate as well. So there are just a lot of issues that we think we need to be a little bit ahead of as this unfolds over the next many decades at a time when we have to produce more, right? Got a 70% goal here to increase food production by 70%, and I'm told by the folks at Pioneer that that's equivalent to all the food that was produced in the last 10,000, the gains that have been made in the last 10,000 years. That's a pretty heavy lift to do in 30, 40 years. Larry?
Mr. Secretary, I'm going to bring up a personal question from a friend of mine that talked to me last week at the state wrestling meet in Kansas. She's the city administrator of a town of 865 people. She said to me, you know, she's always working the USDA grant money, rural development money, always working. She got a brand new fire station last year. And she's very grateful for it. She said, I got a problem here with the situation with this redefinition of rural. And I started looking at it. I said, well, yeah, there's a difference. It's moving from moving out of 50,000. What was the strategic purpose of moving to this larger number as a definition of rural?
Well, it was to provide some degree of consistency between the various programs that we have, because oftentimes it's very confusing, particularly for smaller communities, to know whether they qualify for something, because some program is for less than 20,000, some for less than 10,000, some for 50,000. So it was designed to provide consistency. It doesn't necessarily mean that smaller communities are going to be ignored. I mean, that was the immediate reaction. It shouldn't be. Shouldn't be. That's not the case. That is not the case. It is just about creating a uniformity of definition that will allow folks to understand what rural means in the context of USDA programs, number one. Number two, one of the things that we recognize with rural development is that individual communities, of and by themselves, may not have the human capital or the financial capital to really fundamentally change their economy, but as part of a region, they can contribute to a fundamental change in the economy. So we've been encouraging people to think regionally, collaboratively, to utilize and leverage their resources more effectively. So a definition that's uniform, that sort of encompasses a region as well as a small community, will allow us to help those folks who are thinking regionally and have developed a strategy to be able to get the resources.
As a follow-up, and you talked about thinking regionally rather than a small town, where you can't even get two towns that are 10 miles apart to agree on anything about basketball or wrestling, let alone.
Well, I think we can all agree that wrestling should be an Olympic sport. Which is what I thought your question was going to be.
But the point is that everybody is concerned about that issue. We can't get along between towns and the rivalries there. How are we going to be able to convert that?
Well, you know, that's not the real life experience that's happening. We've seen literally. I think right now we're working with over 50 regions of the country, and these are regions can be as small as a couple of counties working together, or as big as across state lines and multi counties, many multiple counties working together. We've actually seen a real interest in this to understand precisely what will move that economy. How do we use our natural resources within the region more effectively? And having a strategy, and I think people appreciate the fact that we have these cornerstones: production, agriculture, exports, local and regional food systems, conservation, outdoor recreation, and bioeconomy. And they say, where do we fit in that picture? And, you know, and now we'll be able to target and focus resources. And this has been so effective, in my view, that the president has created the promise zone concept, where we're going to go in areas that are really, really struggling, where there's just hardcore poverty, and use this model that we've adopted at USDA. So, I don't think in the real world it's about a small town being left behind. Actually, in the real world, it is about giving that small community an identity within the region and making sure that there are adequate resources going in to create economic activity. You know, when I was a mayor of a small town, I'll never forget this. The town I was mayor of was a town of 8,000 people. And what I thought was interesting was that 11,000 people worked in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, but only 8,000 people lived there. And so I asked the question, how come not all those 3,000 folks who are coming to work live in Mount Pleasant because it's a wonderful town. It's a great town. It's, you know, it's got everything you ever want. And somebody said, well, you know, some people don't like to live in that big a city. Really? And they said, yeah, some people like to live in a town of 1,000 folks. All right. So as a result of that, I thought, okay, then what I need to do as a mayor of the county seat town is I need to help those small towns be as strong as they can be. So I picked up the phone, called the mayors of those small communities, and said, how can we help? Can we share snow equipment? Can we share, you know, tree cutting equipment? Is there a way in which we can train some of your people? Are there ways in which we can collaborate? And the result was a stronger sense of community. So I'm not willing to buy the notion that because you develop a definition that's designed to simplify things that somehow people are going to be left out. I think it's actually to the contrary. I think our focus is really on really providing opportunities for those smaller communities. Yes, sir.
How soon will the results of the sequester be felt? Is there a time lag there?
Well, it's a different timeline for every single missionary and every single account, all right? What I can tell you is that next week notices are going to be sent out to the various employee bargaining units and groups, advising them of furloughs that will take place and starting the clock, if you will, on the notice procedure. I suspect within a week or two, if this thing doesn't get resolved, that we will be communicating to universities and to those who have been receiving awards or grants that might be reduced as a result of sequester, that those resources that you thought you were going to get, you're going to get a little bit less of. I think in terms of producers in farm service offices and NRCS, that will begin to be felt relatively soon, in the sense that that at NRCS we're not filling spots. We're going to have 400 vacancies. So there may be offices where people just simply are not there. In the WIC program, I think the waiting list will begin as soon as we run out of money, which I'm told is relatively soon, and when that happens, we start creating a waiting list of people, and that could grow, according to estimates, as high as 600,000 people. So it depends on, you know, there's not going to be like one single day when you wake up and all of a sudden things are completely different. It's going to be an evolution, and while that's going on, all the other things that are going on in other parts of the government will be going on as well. So a little longer lines at the airports and schools getting notices about not as much federal support. They have to make decisions. Companies are already beginning, especially in the defense area, beginning not to either hire people or notify people that there may be layoffs and shutdowns. So it's beginning to have an effect, and I think over a period of several months you'll see the impact of it. Well, I'll answer the last question first. There are concerns about this, and we've expressed concerns to them. We don't think it's justified, and we'll continue to advocate that. As far as the general concept, we obviously are always supportive of free trade so long as it's balanced and as long as it does, in fact, reduce the barriers that exist on both sides of the ocean. I will tell you that I expressed in the presence of the president and the U.S. Trade Representative, and in the presence of the folks yesterday that we met with from the biotech community, a deep concern that the negotiations take place with a full understanding that agriculture's got to be on the table. It cannot be, you know, put to the side and not discussed and not resolved, because there are serious differences of opinion, obviously, between where we are and where the EU is. There's great opportunity here. You know, it's our fifth or sixth largest market. It could expand significantly if they took a slightly, in my view, a slightly more informed view about beef, a slightly more informed view about biotechnology. I think they're slowly coming to the realization that we've got a heck of a challenge as a humankind to feed this ever-increasing world population, and we better start embracing science and better use it to the extent we can. And I respect the organic piece of their world, and we've got the same piece, and I respect it as well. And there was an equivalency agreement, so that's good. We've begun the conversation in agriculture, but I think we have to be very vigilant on that.
They've been using the word sustainability, their measure of sustainability.
All of that comes on the table because, I mean, sustainability is a very interesting term. I'm not quite sure what it, you know, I suspect if we ask you all to write down the definition of sustainability, even in this room, where there ought to be pretty good consensus, there might be a wide range of views about that. It would be helpful, I think, in the context of these discussions to have an understanding of precisely what that means and to understand the science behind renewable fuel production, because I think a lot of what I find is that a lot of the concerns are sort of old news. There are things that were brought up years ago that aren't true today because the industry has evolved and efficiencies have been developed, and research continues to make it even further more energy efficient and more sustainable. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, they're obviously they heavily support their farmers, and we support our farmers, but I think our support structure and system is absolutely going to change whenever a farm bill gets done here. I mean, there's no question in my mind the level of support is going to decline. It has to, because the deficit reduction pressures. So I think we'll be, in that sense, we'll be in a better, stronger bargaining position. Yes, sir.
Ken? Not directly.
Since direct payments are part of the extension of the farm bill, do you believe that since the program has gone into effect, it has sanctity? Even though Congress decided to remove that later, they still have to pay to everyone entitled or only to those people that have signed up so far?
Ken, I think my view of this sort of goes back to the principles we're applying to sequester. You know, I think it's about equity. Right, I think it's about equity, and I would imagine. Well, I shouldn't imagine what Congress is going to do. I shouldn't do that. Let me say this: we are at USDA. We are fully prepared to operate the program. We started the sign up. Sign up will go from now until August, and on acre, I think it goes now until June. We're committed. We're giving the acre folks an option to get out of that program if they wish. So we're trying to treat people fairly. So we're prepared to fully institute the program because that's what Congress has told us to do. I think there will be an impact on the program with the sequester. I think there may be an impact. Sequester may impact the amount of payments, but I'm not sure it will impact whether people get a payment. And I think anything that Congress does relative to removing or reducing or modifying direct payments as they formulate either a response to sequester or as they formulate a farm bill, I suspect will be in future years. It won't be this particular year. I think it would be very difficult to change the game in the middle of the game, which is what they would be doing if they said, you know what, we told you we're going to get direct payments, but you're not. Chris? Well, let's see. There was BASF was there, Bayer was there, Syngenta was there, Pioneer was there, Monsanto was there, the bio organization representatives were there, Farm Bureau was there, NFU was there. I think that's pretty much who was there. I think the purpose of the meeting was to make sure that folks in the White House appreciated that innovation is occurring in a lot of different places in the American economy and probably very significantly in the agricultural area. And what was interesting, I think, to Valerie Jarrett, who was there, was the fact that so many of the companies who were actually European-based had moved their research programs, their entire research programs from wherever their parent company is located in Europe to the United States. And I think that what they were hoping would be that there would be a continued understanding at the White House about what we know at USDA, which is that this innovation is taking place, it's making a difference, it's made a difference during the drought, it could respond to the president's desire to feed more of the hungry around the world. It is a response in part to climate change, possibly, so that there was a better understanding of the of the importance of this of the innovation and what it has done and what it could do. And the hope would be that, you know, at some point in time, the president would find time in his extraordinarily busy schedule to visit a facility or to come and give a speech, that type of thing. Yes, sir.
Old enough to know that most of these immediate problems, somewhere down the road, it's going to be solved. You've been an advocate of beginning the young farmer programs and have instituted a lot of that. With the Census of Agriculture now, we're going to find out more about who is there.
Well, wait a second. Let me stop you right there. You're assuming that the census is going to be completed, and that's not an assumption that you should make, because this sequester has an impact on that as well. Go ahead.
Okay. Are you getting a lot of interest from young and beginning farmers, and is there more that we need to do?
Well, I can tell you that 1.5 million farmers have responded to the census already, which is a great return, which is why we're a little concerned about the impact of the sequester and our ability to process all that data in a timely way. I think there's, you know, this is anecdotal. It's not driven on the data because I haven't seen the data. But anecdotally, I think there's a lot of interest on the part of young people to participate in one form or another of agriculture. I know I've met with FFA kids, and there's a lot of enthusiasm in that traditional group. But I've also been on college campuses and university campuses where kids have come up and said, you know, I don't live on a farm, but I'm really interested in this, and another group that's expressed interest are returning veterans, which is why we started a program. You know, as we closed some of these labs, I think this was in Georgia or Florida, one of these two states, it's surrounded by land, right? These ARS labs surrounded by land. And when we close a lab, we have to dispose of the land. And the way the law requires us to do that is we basically essentially offer it to the university that we're co-located on. And we've done that. But this time, instead of just simply saying, here it is, you take over responsibility and we'll make sure that the buildings are safe and so forth, we said, we'd like you to see if you would be interested in using this land to help assist beginning and new farmers. Make it available to them, rent it out to them, utilize it in a creative way to encourage and to foster beginning and farmer folks. So I think that's we've done this in a couple of places, and I think, you know, the reality of the ARS system, we have 122 facilities, and we probably aren't going to be able to maintain all of those facilities in the future. So as we think about reducing those numbers and consolidating our research in the best facilities, then there may be other opportunities like that. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot of interest in this.
Secretary, I've heard farmers say that crop insurance is too good. There's no risk left, and their most recent anecdotal evidence is we had a record farm income after a 56-year drought. Do you think they're on the mark there? Is there room for more cuts in crop insurance?
Well, I think I'd be I think there are always ways that you can improve programs. So I want to make sure that in answering your question, I don't recognize that there are efficiencies that can always be created, and maybe there's a particular policy that is not quite fair in terms of the percentage the government picks up and the percentage that the farmer picks up, that kind of thing. But in terms of the basis of the program, you got to keep it. And you particularly have to keep it if you're going to remove and eliminate direct payments and, you know, come up with something else that is not in addition to, but is in a sense complementary and feeds off of crop insurance, all right, or covers the area that crop insurance doesn't cover. Given the expense of what it takes to put a crop in the ground today, I think that's one thing people may not fully appreciate and understand. It's expensive. It's really expensive to put a crop in the ground. And one or two bad years can take a mature operation under, and it clearly can take a beginning operation under. So I'd be a little reluctant to say that it's too good a deal, and I would be very reluctant to say that in the context of what I think is likely to happen, which is the direct payments are likely to be changed dramatically. But are there things around the edges, tweaks that could be done to save a little money here or there? Well, I think that's probably true of crop insurance.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned that there are $1 to $2 billion in indemnity payments yet to be paid for the 2012.
That's an estimate. It's an estimate.
Okay, but that's a contractual arrangement that farmers have with USDA. So is that exempt from sequester?
That won't be impacted by sequester. Those payments will be made. And they, nor will they be clawed back, which is what we're dealing with in some of the other programs that are subject to. The sequester is this whole notion of, well, we've already paid people, and now you're telling us we have to reduce the budget by X every line item. Does that mean things we've actually paid out? I can't tell you how complicated this process is, and I can't tell you how much time. If you think about all that time that is being taken to sort of figure out all these intricacies out and then to implement whatever has to be implemented. So, you know, there are only so many hours in a day, and the workload that these folks are doing at USDA hasn't abated. It's not like we got, you know, farmers not interested in getting credit or rural communities not wanting housing. We didn't talk about housing out there today because it's probably not germane to the audience, but the housing programs get hit very hard, and we're probably looking at over 10,000 people who will lose their rent assistance, and I don't know what that means for them and what it means for the people who own the buildings or the apartment buildings that they're living in, whether, you know, what financial hardship that causes. And there are hundreds of loans, home loans, that won't be completed just simply because we don't have the resources. Jeff, just let me make sure that everybody's been asked a question. Well, I think that I'm reluctant to say yes or no. I'm just saying that this is an issue what we're trying to do, frankly, on this equity principle and least disruptive principle, we're trying to figure out, are there ways in which you can work around something like that? There clearly are circumstances today where people have been paid and people who have not been paid, and there is an interesting debate about what does sequester do? Does it require you to claw back, or does it force you to ding the people who weren't fortunate enough to get their money before a higher percentage in order to get to the overall percent? I mean, it's just what I'm trying to impress upon all of you is how crazy this all is, and how it could always, remember the one last thing, it can always be resolved and avoided if Congress would just simply do its job and figure the deficit situation out and get a budget and then get a farm bill. All these problems are man-made. It's not like a drought where we got, you know, no impact, no capacity to change it.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned before the advantage of renewable fuels to the rural economy, what that can mean. Following your biotech meeting at the White House, what role do you see genetic enhancement and biotechnology playing in agriculture, meeting its role domestically and globally?
Well, it's a couple of things, Jeff. Number one, it increases productivity opportunities. At a time when we have this enormous challenge. Number two, it allows us to adapt and mitigate potentially to changing climates so that we continue to be productive. So it not only increases productivity, but it sort of ensures the capacity to produce. Number three, I think, is as we learn more about as we do more genetic research and mapping, the day will come when you have a particular type of corn that's particularly suited, or a particular soybean that's particularly suited, or a particular canola, whatever crop, particularly a sorghum, whatever, suited for a particular purpose. So what happens is you begin to change a commodity that has a commodity price structure to an ingredient, which is a higher value proposition. So kind of what the organics folks said, they have a higher value proposition. We need more of those opportunities of higher value. So there are a multitude of benefits to this. We've got to do it smart. We've got to do it making sure we understand fully and completely the impact that the science has on the plant and surrounding plants. And I think we have to be respectful of the fact that some people are not going to adopt that approach and want to adopt a different approach, and that we don't do anything that compromises their ability for their higher value proposition. It's really about trying to get along. And actually, what we're trying to model in agriculture is what I'm encouraging Congress to do, which we And I think agriculture, I mean, honestly, I think agriculture is in a different place than it was a couple of years ago. I think there are conversations. There's still a lot of, you know, a lot of tension, a lot of conflict. But I think people are talking to each other. I think people are beginning to realize that there are reasonable people on all sides of this. And they're, you know, we're working through the AC21 recommendations, and that's a step forward. The folks who were in that meeting, I think, recognized that we've made some progress. And we certainly have made progress in regulatory reform by reducing the amount of time it takes us to do the work that we need to do to make sure that these things are safe and appropriate under the Plant Pest Protection Act. And one of the benefits, you know, I don't want to – it's not all negative. I mean, the whole budget issue has forced us, and over the last 2 years, forced us to really think about what we do and how we do it and who does it and where it's done. And I think, you know, if we could ever get to a point where there was certainty about the long term, that we weren't faced with these man-made crises every 3 months. I mean, it just give you a sense of this. These USDA workers, they're faced with sequester, right? And then 3 weeks from now, we're going to be at the continuing resolution expiration, and we don't know for sure that there's going to be any budget after March 27th, do we? I told this story to folks earlier. I mean, this is the human part of this. I was in an elevator at the federal building in Des Moines. I got on the elevator, and this young lady got on, and she looked up at me. She turned around, and she looked up to me, and she said, "Am I going to have a job next week?" And, you know, when you're faced with something like that, you could try to reassure her, but then again, you wouldn't necessarily be honest with her. And I said, "Well, you know, honestly, I don't know. We'll just have to see. We'll do everything we can." This young lady, I mean, I don't know what her situation was. I don't know if she was just out of college with a college loan or whether she was just married and they were working, you know, she and her husband were working on a budget that was pretty tight. But it was obvious to me that this young lady was stressed. And when she went back to whatever job she had at NRCS, her mind, a part of her mind, was, "Am I going to be working here next week?" Now, you all put yourself in that same circumstance. How much concentration would you have? And if you've been doing this for now months, right, we've had a crisis of, you know, and not have any certainty, you can understand these folks, but yet they still do the job. We have record home loans, record farm loans, record conservation acres enrolled, record expansion of bioeconomy, record expansion of local and regional food systems, supported in part by USDA folks. So I'm really proud of the work they're doing, but I feel for them right now because it is very stressful. Thank you all. Thank you.